This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
One of the issues has been in such a small state is that, particularly with wind turbines, is that there's been some pushback. This year in particular, there were about three or four projects that I think had, where the developers had done a fair amount of work and done their research on it and had was, you know, getting very close to making it a reality when they were just halted right in their tracks.
Frequency Change Radio listeners know that we've covered many California-related environmental issues over the years, and for good reason. As the country's most populous state, it's an important barometer of our progress in the fight to become more sustainable. But what about our nation's smallest state, Rhode Island? It counts too. This week, as we mark another year, we learn about the environmental issues facing Little Rhode Island with Tim Faulkner, the executive editor of EcoRI News. We'll explore the challenges facing the alternative energy industry there, as well as some of the long-term policy goals that Rhode Island state government has set forth. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Tim Faulkner. He's the executive editor of EcoRI News, which is Rhode Island's environmental news source. Tim, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
First, tell us a little bit about what EcoRI News is about, how long you've been together, and what the mission of the organization is.
Well, we're an online environmental news website, and essentially we refer to ourselves as an online newspaper. In fact, I am a former newspaper reporter along with Frank Carini, who is one of the founders of the of EcoRI. And so we primarily cover issues that are, you know, related to pollution or to agriculture, renewable energy. You know, certainly there's no shortage of environmental issues in any state. And so we do a combination of traditional journalism, investigative reporting, and some outreach as well. We'll do things like compost collection programs and educational projects and things that we'll present at schools. You know, it's a small group. There's about four of us that run it. We're sort of in a bit of a startup stage, but we're growing and we're getting a lot of great feedback from the people across the state.
Give us a snapshot of Rhode Island if you can, Tim.
Sure. So it's densely populated, and there's a little bit of everything going on here. I think right now one of the issues is that the state has been grappling with for the past 4 or 5 years is looking at how we can address our energy needs. I think about 98% of our electricity is powered by natural gas, and there's been an effort, I think primarily directed from the State House, to help us diversify, you know, not only reduce our carbon footprint, but also reduce our reliance on such a, you know, heavy reliance on a single source of energy. And that has put forth a lot of legislation on creating incentives for solar projects and wind projects. And it's been, you know, modeled off a number of other state programs, and it's done well so far. This year, it hit a few bumps in the road, but the state has been very strong in reacting and modifying a lot of the incentives so that looks like it's going to go ahead and be stronger as it moves forward.
Rhode Island is the ocean state, so these wind energy projects and other alternative energy projects, I imagine, would be looking towards offshore development. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. I think that was one of the first initiatives, was an offshore project about 10 miles offshore near Block Island.
Well, a lot of us are familiar with the Cape Wind project that was on Cape Cod that got a lot of national attention because of some high-profile protest to people's sight lines and stuff. But I also know Block Island is a fairly tony, small, but very cool little island off of Rhode Island. Give us a snapshot of how the wind project there has developed and how wind energy continues to spread in the region.
Well, it's very similar to the Cape Wind project. I think it was supposed to break ground, I think, next year, but it looks like that might be delayed for another few more months, if not a year. But it's being the developer is called Deepwater Wind, and they're based in Providence, and they are creating what they're terming as like a test wind farm, a smaller scale farm, which would have 5 turbines about a mile or two, I think, off of Block Island. And Block Island has been fairly receptive to the project as a whole. One of the reasons being is that they are the only, you know, all of their power comes from diesel energy and comes from diesel generators. So I think that there is they're seeing that as a favorable trade-off to have their energy come from wind as opposed to diesel, which is, you know, actually very expensive right now and not great for the environment.
Well, would the project just be supporting the grid for Block Island, or would it also be going to mainland Rhode Island?
Both. I mean, it's, as you know, Block Island is seasonal, so they think that it would probably power, most of the wind energy would go to powering the Block Island during, you know, the summer season, and then in the off season that the additional electricity would run into, you know, the rest of the power grid for the state. And so it's sort of not just for them. It looks to be real beneficial for everybody in the state, except that one of the complaints about the project has been that it's very costly, that the cost per kilowatt hour is significantly higher than it would be for, you know, standard electric use, and typically even for renewable energy projects. I think that's been one of the criticisms of offshore energy projects, is that it is a lot more expensive for the electricity that you're getting, and the cost is typically spread out to the utility customers to have to pay for that. So as you can imagine, there's been some pushback from the cost standpoint.
So, Tim, although we always see in the national presidential election Rhode Island goes blue traditionally, it's not a straight Democratic state, is it?
Right. Yeah, I don't think we're as liberal as maybe, and I think most states kind of, as California probably might as well, gets painted with that broad brush of being a liberal bastion of progressive, you know, ideas. But I think it's definitely more of a blue collar, I think, Democratic state, and certainly with a strong immigrant population, and I think a fairly strong union representation as well. So I think that's a big part of that voting bloc.
And what kind of green jobs initiatives are underway in Rhode Island, and what kind of federal funds have gone towards this? And maybe give us an idea of the political struggles that have been underway to launch more of these wind projects like the Block Island one.
I think a lot of the funding, federal and state funding, has been geared, and, you know, for green jobs, has been through renewable energy projects and incentives to build more solar and wind turbines. And so there was a legislation a couple of years ago that was passed, which was set what's called distributed generation contract pricing. And what that means is that any sort of larger scale wind or solar or even hydro could get fixed pricing for 15 years for the sale of their electricity to the utility. And so that's great for developing the projects, because then the developer has a sort of fixed financial model from which they can, you know, create a business plan. So that's been very well received and very receptive, and it's been getting a lot of, I think a lot of developers have been applying for this program, and, you know, they're working on making that better every year. One of the issues has been, of course, is that in such a small state, is that particularly with wind turbines, is that there's been some pushback. This year in particular, there were about 3 or 4 projects that I think had where the developers had done a fair amount of work and done their research on it, and was, you know, getting very close to making it a reality when they were just halted right in their tracks. So one of the wind turbines, you know, Rhode Island's a small state, so any news about any turbine, you know, just you can pretty much see any turbine from anywhere across the state. But there was a turbine that was, I think, put up in 2009 that ran into some gearbox failures. And this turbine was a project that was a municipal-led project, meaning that the town that it was built in, you know, sort of coordinated it and financed it. And when the turbine broke, they went back to the company that built it, and they were out of business. So And with Rhode Island, you can't really build, you know, there's, it's harder to build a project with maybe more than one or two turbines. So that's another reason that they can be a little bit risky to build, that if, you know, if, as the Portsmouth turbine had happened, if something breaks, then the whole project is really in trouble.
Is that a zoning or a code issue, or is that just because of the relative small population of the state?
Right. It's the density of the state.
I see.
There really is not a lot of space. So that's why offshore is being seen. There's been such a big push for offshore. And then there was another project that has been about 3 or 4 years has been in the works called the East Bay Energy Consortium. And what that is, it's a really unique collaborative of about 9 different communities that are working together to create one bigger wind or solar project that they can put their resources in together and then also get some of the funds back from selling the electricity. So they have a project that was in the works for about 2 years, and they had a site set up. They're looking to maybe put together about 8 to 10 turbines, which is very big for Rhode Island. And it ran into significant opposition at the State House once they tried to establish legislation to create the East Bay Energy Consortium as its own entity, sort of a quasi-government agency. And that got a lot of pushback, and the project hasn't been defeated, but it's really going to have to modify itself in a big way. So that was one of the major, I think, defeats for wind energy this year, was that sort of a first substantial mini wind farm ran into some big opposition.
Copper, it comes from Arizona. Peaches come from Georgia, and lobsters come from Maine. Well, the wheat fields are sweet fields in Nebraska, and Kansas gets bonanzas from the grain. And old whiskey comes from old Kentucky. Ain't the country lucky? New Jersey gives us glue. And you come from Rhode Island. Little old Rhode Island, it's famous for you. Cotton, it comes from Louisiana. Gophers from Montana.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Tim Faulkner. He's the executive editor of EcoRI News. Tim, you mentioned how 98% of Rhode Island's power grid comes from natural gas currently, but long-term goals have been set to have the state powered by 16% renewables by 2019. That sounds pretty aggressive. Do you think it'll happen?
It can be done. I mean, I think that they've done the math that show that, you know, with a certain amount, I mean, they've done some great mapping, I think, of the state of where, you know, would be ideal for wind and solar. I mean, that was a big thing this year, is that there's sort of a public resource that developers can use to look at where it'd be the ideal locations to put up certain types of renewable energy projects. So I think that it is achievable, but certainly maybe not by 2016. But I think that there's there's sort of this constant modification of the legislation and the rules for the distributed generation program, so that they can entice more developers to put up renewable projects. So this year there's been a few big solar array projects that are going atop landfills. Those are in the works and should be hopefully online next year. And that, I think, will really help the state meet its renewable energy targets.
Can you give us an idea of the actors who are putting up barriers to this change?
I think it's been a mix. I think, especially a lot of the resistance to wind projects in particular has come when cities and towns themselves try and embark on their own wind project in particular. The Portsmouth turbine gearbox failure, which is maybe going to cost the town, it looks like maybe $500,000, was used as the prime example for why towns really got cold feet about going forward with wind turbines, which, in a densely populated state, there was a lot of people that, you know, don't like seeing them in their backyards, and they have concerns about shadow flicker and fall zones and the noise from the turbine.
What is shadow flicker? I've never heard of that.
Well, shadow flicker is when essentially the shadow from the turbine.
Just like a fan in a room annoys some people, this is like a fan that's everywhere, and it could be annoying to some people, huh?
Exactly. And there's been, I don't think there's any scientific evidence of it, but there's even like a shadow flicker syndrome, I think, that is sort of brought about that as one of the health risks, which I think that's been disproved. But I think in a community that might be making a sizable investment, and certainly with staff and with other resources, that you can understand that there might be some trepidation about these projects. So the ones that have moved forward, I think, have been the private developed projects, where maybe somebody will do it on their own property on a farm, or if they've got some real estate where they can put it up and finance it themselves. Those are the projects where there's less sort of resistance from the public, and they have more better success at being built. And then on the state level, I think when there's been, again, it takes a small sort of dedicated group to pretty much get anything done. And there were a couple of organizations that I think united, some with connections to the Tea Party that saw this sort of expansion of wind energy as a real overreach of state government, and worrying that it was going to, I think in particular, there were some objections about a need for eminent domain in one of the projects, and that and even got the governor involved, who was a pretty pro-renewable energy governor, to at one point oppose that larger East Bay energy project.
This is Lincoln Chafee.
Right, right.
Is he still an independent? I know he was a Republican and then he switched to independent, or I mix him up with Charlie Crist. They're all jumping around parties at this point. But
right. No, he was a Republican.
But he's pretty pro alternative energy.
He is, definitely. And I think that's been one of the attacks that that perhaps you're seeing nationally as well as in Rhode Island, is that there's not a real overt campaign where you're seeing big sort of high profile announcements or ceremonies about new renewable energy incentives, that they're trying to maybe keep it a little more low key, but still push forward with it as much as they can without drawing a lot of attention to it. So I think there definitely is that commitment from the governor's office, but they really are. I haven't had much success getting them to talk on the record about what their objectives are, but they have been advancing renewable energy projects, and even on a small scale too. Even just yesterday, they announced that they're increasing incentives for smaller scale, say solar projects for residential projects or small businesses. And that has been one area that's been lacking, where neighboring states have had a lot of success is with sort of the small rooftop solar projects, and Rhode Island's trying to create incentives for that as well.
A little off subject here, but I'm curious to get your take on this. There was a high-profile bankruptcy of a video game startup run by former Red Sox, Arizona, and Phillies pitcher Curt Schilling. What exactly happened in this instance, Tim? And wasn't there a bit of a tie-in with Green Initiative monies?
You kind of got to dig a little deeper, but when that East Bay Energy Consortium wanted to become their own quasi-state agency, once that got some resistance, they decided, oh, well, let's go be a subsidiary of the State Economic Development Corporation, which, you know, as soon as when they tried to make that shift, that happened exactly as Curt Schilling's company exploded, and the Economic Development Corporation was the entity that had funded Curt Schilling. So that pretty much sank the efforts by EBEC, by the Energy Consortium. And so the EDC has, as part of it, what's called the Renewable Energy Fund. And this is a fund that gets a portion of utility bills, help fund it every year. I think they get about $5 million a year. And then so the Renewable Energy Fund will issue loans and grants to renewable energy projects, or to maybe promising sort of alternative fuel projects, like biofuels, or I know there's a guy who's doing an algae program, carbon sequestering program that gets funding. But so this is within the EDC, and then the EDC was catching, and the Renewable Energy Fund had, in fact, as they've funded most renewable energy projects, they had given money to the East Bay Energy Consortium to help them with their wind studies. So anybody that was in any way connected with the EDC this summer or this back in June, was, you know, it was kind of dead in the water. And although there was no sort of malfeasance related to the Renewable Energy Fund, they were just sort of guilty by association. it was such a gamble by the governor to put so much money into, which is, it wasn't Chafee, it was his predecessor, Don Kachiri, who's a Republican. And in fact, I think he had met Kurt Schilling at a party at Schilling's house. And I think that's how the whole thing got started. That Schilling was hosting some sort of fundraiser and the governor was there. And that's how he said, yeah, why don't you check out our, you know, the EDC funding that we could possibly send your way, which they did. And yeah.
He just kind of schmoozed them and they were like, you're a Republican. I like baseball.
Right.
Here's $125 million.
And it's just, you know, and with any company, I think you need a lot of luck, but it just seems that he was just spending so much money, you know, using a lot more, I think, of his charm than his business savvy.
Follow The Shift to Sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Tim Faulkner. He's the executive editor of EcoRI News. So, Tim, we've talked about how offshore wind projects are one of the only greener pastures, so to speak, for alternative energy projects to go because of the density of the state. But I can't help but think that waste management and garbage is going to be, would be an issue in a small state like Rhode Island. The link between the ocean and the land must play an important role in waste management as well. Have you worked on any pieces in terms of Narragansett Bay and other offshore areas and how Rhode Island is handling its waste stream?
Right. Well, fortunately, Rhode Island is no longer dumping trash right from barges into the ocean, which I think they probably did as early as maybe 30 or 40 years ago. But, you know, there's our onshore, we only have one landfill in the state, and that's expected to fill to capacity in about 20 to 25 years. So that's always, raising the issue of how do we slow that down and what do we do for, you know, other ways of finding ways to cut down on our waste. So looking at ways to maybe remove food waste and other organics from the waste stream. And then in the bay itself, I think they've done a lot of new projects in recent years that has reduced at least runoff and other wastewater from heading into the bay. So there's been a huge upgrade in wastewater treatment facilities. And then in dredging, that's also an issue because in Rhode Island is so dependent on boat traffic and shipping that comes in and out of the bay. So there's always a need for maintenance dredging and widening and deepening of channels and just maintaining the channels.
Well, you talked about how up to 30 years ago there was dumping right into the bay. I imagine this dredging would bring up some of these contaminants from years of poor waste management, or is that not the case? Can you maybe give us an idea of the toxicity of these dredging efforts and if there's been any kind of red flags that you and your colleagues have been able to uncover there?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's, Rhode Island, like much of the Northeast, has a huge industrial history to it. So there is worries of high amounts of metals and other toxins that are in the bay itself. Fortunately, the testing has shown that it's not as bad as other sites. And so the dredging material, they've been able to, I guess, sort of dump it offshore, the stuff that's, I mean, their first and best preference is to have any of the dredging material, particularly if it's more of a sandy type of material is to use it for beach renourishment or even onshore projects like that would want clean fill. Unfortunately, a lot of the material that's in Narragansett Bay is very silty, and some of it, you know, is contaminated. And I think some of the contaminants they found are gas and oil and zinc and some other metals and even low levels of mercury. So they have to find a home for some of that. And the bay is as big as it is, it still has its limits, and certainly finding places to store that waste has been difficult. So they do have an area that's going to be getting close to capacity, which is within Providence Harbor. They're called CAD cells, which are these sort of special open pits where they can dump the more contaminated material and eventually will cap it. But that's going to fill up in a couple of years. So
these are underwater?
They're underwater, right. Yep. So they dig down about another 50 feet below the bottom of the floor of the bay. And they'll, you know, they're probably, I'm not sure what the exact size is, but they're the size of at a few thousand square feet each. I think there's maybe a dozen of the CAD cells, and but they're filling up because a lot of the routine maintenance that goes on in the bay for dredging of channels and shipping lanes goes into these CAD cells on a regular basis. So that's you know, another issue that they're trying to find a place to, you know, to put all this excessive waste.
And this isn't just done in Providence Harbor; it's also done in the river, Providence River. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, the Providence River runs through the harbor itself. So the Providence River will run down through about halfway down the bay, and that's the busiest shipping lane. And there are even other parts of the Providence River, which are up beyond the harbor, which haven't been touched yet. And so those are areas that there's debate about what to do, because those areas are likely more contaminated. But they're probably in need of some cleaning and dredging as well, just, I think, for health purposes. Okay, so it's an ongoing issue. It's just really how to keep the bay healthy and what to do with the material.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking with Tim Faulkner. He's the executive editor of EcoRI News. Tim, you said that Rhode Island is one of the densest states population-wise in the country. With the alternative energy efforts in mind, it would seem a perfect place for some pretty forward-thinking public transportation efforts.
Well, there's certainly been a lot of effort, I think, to try and revamp public transportation in Rhode Island, and it hasn't, you know, brought much success. I think since 1995, there have probably been six different either blue ribbon panels or commissions that were initiated by the governor's office or the General Assembly to try and figure out how to improve the public transit system. And the principal difficulty they're having is financing it. They get most of their funding. The Rhode Island Public Transit Authority gets most of their funding through a gas tax. And when the price of gas goes up, fewer people are buying gas and taking public transportation. So the revenue that goes into the public transit goes down. And because of that, they've been trying to really shift that model as far as finding ways to increase the funding for that. So it's, you know, the RPTA, which is the Rhode Island Public Transit Authority, is still seen as a very effective, you know, system, but it's one that operates at a huge deficit every year. And, there's always talk of cutting routes and access and staff and drivers. So, but there are a lot of big initiatives. There's a one called Transportation 25, which is looking at, you know, ways to sort of improve the public transit and make communities more walkable and bikeable, and kind of adopting a lot of the smart growth development principles.
Well, people can learn more about what's going on in Rhode Island and its environmental efforts by going to ecori.org. Tim Faulkner, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex. It's been a pleasure.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Jimi Hendrix, Aaron McKeown, and Jimmy Cliff. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.